Blog Talk Radio.
To Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Pam Chaddock, Chuck Thurston, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Here we are.
How are things this morning? We were just talking before we went on air about how, the beautiful weather that we're having this morning. It's a beautiful morning here in Colorado. We just had two full days of rain, lots of rain. We actually broke some records, so it's great to see the blue sky and the sunshine this morning, and all the birds are happy. And isn't that great? I love being outdoors when it's like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking the day. Probably going to go take some great pictures.
Green.
Yeah, everything's turning green, right?
Dandelions are going crazy. Carpets of yellow.
Yeah, true. It's when the wildflowers all come out. So.
Yeah. Nice to think of dandelions as a wildflower. It kind of recontextualizes them.
You know, I always think of our friend Brigitte Mars, who speaks very highly of dandelions and their many wonderful properties for healing and, you know, for other benefits. They're not just a weed. They have a lot of value, actually. So she loves to point out. She does herb walks, and it's really wonderful. I don't know if you guys have ever had a chance to do an herb walk with her, but she's really quite extraordinary. And
even
her knowledge.
Just around
of,
her, even just around her house.
Flower
beds, well, so you can, like, eat her lawn. Or
whatever. Yeah, you could eat her lawn. Exactly.
Well, this is gardens. So it's cool to know so much about that. It's very unusual.
I know. I've rarely encountered anyone who knows more about that than she does.
I know.
Maybe Hannah Kroger, and I would say they were equal, you know.
Huh.
Hannah was another famous Boulderite who has an herb store in Boulder, and when it was on the Pearl Street Mall, there used to be a line going down the block just waiting to consult with her. An old German lady. She died years ago, but her retreat center is still in Boulder, and her herbal remedies, her herbal concoctions are still available there.
Huh.
The other businesses on Pearl Street got mad because Hannah's clientele was always forming a line down the block and blocking access to other stores, so they made Hannah leave Pearl Street.
No way.
And so she just went, yeah. And so she just put her herb store at her retreat center, which has a lovely little chapel and a full-service retreat, you know, accommodations and everything, outside of Boulder in a beautiful spot. When you're there, you almost feel like you're alone, you know, even though you're pretty much in Boulder. But it's, that's Hannah. And Brigitte's every bit as knowledgeable as she was about herbs and herbal remedies. So there's a shout out to our friend Brigitte, remarkable woman who lives and teaches in Boulder and has been invited to teach all over the world. The author of many books, we've actually had her on the show. So she's definitely one of a kind and a beloved friend in this community, in our Uranch community in Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, guys, we are fully into the middle of our study on God, which is the first five papers of the Urantia book, and we've made it to paper three, section three. Let's see, the universe, God's universal knowledge, and what a delight it is to study these papers with you guys. I just can't express how much it means to me. Mm-hmm. I've been so looking forward to it. Every week I just look forward to rediscovery of the amazing and wonderful nature of our Heavenly Father and all of His amazing attributes, which is paper three, is the attributes of God. And any reflections on where we at so far and before we begin to read?
Well, Paula, I just want to thank you once again for establishing this wonderful forum. All these years, you've been so present and loyal and inspirational, and it's soul nourishing and it's just, thank you so much. You've been mothering this wonderful project for a long time.
Yeah. You know, the way I look at it, and as a young reader, I was probably 21, 22 years old, and I was two-thirds of the way through the Urantia book. And it was changing my life in every way for the better. Changing my worldview, changing my heart, the level of joy and peace that I had, you know, because prior to finding it, I was pretty mad at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, Jesus saying, don't be mad at the world. It's just men and women working together in a dispensation. That's what the Urantia book did for me. It put everything into perspective, right? It just put it all into perspective. And it does it in such a beautiful and magnificent way. And that never wears off for me, and I know you guys feel the same way. I mean, that's why we're all devoted, obviously. Chuck, you know, Andre and you, Pam, we've given everything to this. We're willing to go out way out on a limb for it, right? Because it means that much to us, and it has meant that much to us. And I wrote this letter to Urantia Foundation. I actually tuned into a Christian radio broadcast when I was, you know, like I said, about two-thirds of the way through. And they were reading the Bible, and it was classic hellfire and brimstone, and you know. And here I felt so thoroughly touched by a revelation of truth, and you know, the Bible, as good as it is, it's just not the same. You know, it's profound and beautiful, but so few things come to the level of the Urantia book. In terms of, you know, theology and teachings about God. And here we are in the middle of this study. And I wrote to Urantia Foundation. I said, why isn't this thing being read on the radio? You know, why are we not getting this word out there? The teachings are so sublimely beautiful. Why is it not being read on the radio? And I got back pretty much the party line. You know, it was actually Emma Christensen wrote me back and said, you know, quiet one-on-one word of mouth is the only way to spread the Urantia book. And for me, that struck me as discordant then as it does now. You know, it's like saying, well, I'm standing on the shore with a life preserver and there's someone drowning, but I'm going to argue about which color the preserver is and is it the right color for for this drowning person right now while they drown, you know?
Wow.
And that's the way, and maybe it's because that's what the Urantia book did for me. It saved me. It saved me from drowning in a sea of despair.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, to argue about what color the preserver is, or whether it's the right preserver to throw at this time because that guy drowning out there is not ready for it. I don't know. I just feel like, you know, the act is ours. The consequences are God's.
There you go.
You know, to me, that's like one of the most simple and profound truths around. We just need to act with integrity and love and light. And let God hold all the consequences. We need to act according to our highest understanding.
Yes.
And, you know, in good faith. And know that God, you know, sometimes you can do the right thing, you know, at the wrong time and the wrong thing at the right time and whatever. I mean, but you have to do something. And so that's why, for me, reading this book on the radio, on Blog Talk Radio, where not only is it, it's not limited to the broadcast of however far a radio broadcast can reach. It's on the Internet. It conceivably can go around the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's special to me.
Yes.
That's a dream come true.
Yeah.
So
beautiful.
Yeah.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear.
I
can't even imagine.
Change. You know, we're not just limited to the reach of an AM or FM signal the way it used to be.
Right.
And plus it's there all the time, and there's an archive.
Yes.
That
right.
People can go to also. So this is kind of
right.
a cool thing about this new stage of communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's meant to be.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how you guys feel about that, but
Yeah, we've had people tune in from around the world. We had an Australian that was tuning in regularly a few years ago, and he would share what he wanted to share, and it's accessible anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And on the archive as well, and we know, you know, the vast majority of listeners listen on the archive, listen to the podcast or the recorded shows, which is wonderful, you know? And it's like Diane always likes to tell me, because she was sitting here beside me in 2008 when we did our first show, and we were just back from the Urantia, the Fellowships Conference in L.A., and she said, Paula, you never know who's listening. And that's true. Again, the consequences are God's, right? You just have to act in good faith. And there's a beautiful song by a singer-songwriter named Kirtana. She lives in Hawaii. And she, in one of the lyrics in her song, says, you know, one light calling in you. in me. I'm only following from where I am as best I can, the light I see. And to me, that is really about the religion of personal spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Beautiful.
Well, that's kind of what I like about it. I mean, exactly. We don't just read the book. We also talk about it. And you know,
right.
We try to keep that in balance. But but still, I mean, I think the discussion is an important part of it because, you know, we're demonstrating that these concepts can be talked about. You know, they can be processed through our individual experiences and our own
mm-hmm.
understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
be able to sort of demonstrate that in real time, I think, hopefully is also helpful.
Well,
and
agree.
The repleteness of this revelation so surpasses the beauty of the Bible. But the Bible, in comparison, is not replete. It doesn't speak to us today as much as the Urantia book revelation does.
It's pretty modern.
Although many people are still getting, because of the Jesusonian aspect, many people are getting great inspiration and spirit of truth understanding from that level. But, oh, my God, you know, it's like Vern always talked about the pogo stick, you know. You know, religion is not a crutch. It's a pogo stick. And, you know, the Urantia book is a pogo stick at least. It's a rocket.
With a great big spring.
Yeah, I was going to say a rocket booster.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So
that's so true. And just an example, you know, and I certainly don't want to offend anybody who loves the Bible, because the Bible launched a bazillion ships religiously, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's a compilation of different works over a long period of time. But let's just take, for example, one book, and that's Revelation. And so much has been misunderstood
mm-hmm.
in humanity because of that one book, which the Urantia book says, you know, John, our beloved John, I woke up this morning thinking of our beloved Zebedee brothers and the apostles. I've been contemplating for the last several days how we call them saints. And what a blessing it is to not think of them that way. How much more I love them, knowing them
yes.
from the teachings
yeah.
of the Urantia book. To know
yeah,
them, I feel
point.
Like I know them intimately. They're brothers, they're colleagues, peers even, not saints. You know,
I
don't know. Maybe you know in the way they define it, maybe they are saints as Catholicism would define them, but certainly we owe them a deep debt of gratitude for all they've done for us and can probably continue to do for us from on high.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
it's nice to know them as brothers. And, you know, and John, I was thinking about John Zebedee, John and James, because as a kid I went to St. Philip's and St. James. And so I was wondering which James they were talking about. He was the first to die, right, of the apostles. And so I'm thinking, you know, James was impetuous, and it's nice to know that about him so that we don't make the same mistakes that he made, right? And I was thinking about our brother John Zebedee. And what a wonderful, amazing apostle. And the one that lived the longest, and he wrote that revelation. He had that revelation on the Isle of Patmos. And the Urantia book tells us, but it became garbled and discombobulated. And whole sections of it are missing, which explains why it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Well, parts of it, I mean, I just did a search. You could do this later if you feel like it. If you just do a search on Revelation Ezekiel parallels, you'll find a number of sites where they're showing how huge parts of Revelation are essentially just lifted from Ezekiel.
Oh.
Ezekiel had visions. you know, this is very Old Testament stuff. So somehow or another, somebody decided, well, we'll pull out all the stuff that John was told, and we'll just stick in all this stuff from Ezekiel instead.
We'll embellish.
Right. You can easily research that. There's sites, you know, sort of like Matthew Block and his parallel, where you go through and look at Revelation in one column and look at Ezekiel in the other column. You can see how, like, so much of it is just pulled from Ezekiel. So how that happened,
right.
I don't know. But they were all these guys were having visions, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how that works.
Yeah.
But John,
well,
he had a bona fide revelation. I mean, the parts that are preserved, and you can tell reading through it, there's a complete change in character from the authentic stuff from John and all this other stuff that got stuck in there. Because, I don't know, you sort of read with the eyes of the Spirit, you begin to kind of parse that and see what was real. But I think that, I mean, I could be wrong, but I've always had this theory that revelation that was given to John was to begin to open up our understanding of the more cosmic picture of reality. You know, because Jesus didn't really talk about the rest of the universe. You know, he said, well, my Father's house are many mansions. I mean, he gave some hints, but nothing in great detail. He was all pretty much earthbound, you know, just trying to get to the essence of getting to know God and the real nature of God and all of that. But John, on the other hand, he opens up with more of a picture of the greater, how all this fits into the greater universe. And I think that was maybe kind of the purpose of John's revelation, you know, pre-Urantia book, to begin to introduce another conceptual level that frames Jesus and his life and his teachings in this bigger context of universe reality. And that's why it's such a shame that we don't have the actual version of his revelation. Because, you know, he saw Jerusalem, he saw a lot of things that, you know, the Urantia book sort of points out that, you know, are bona fide. But then there's all this other stuff that kind of garbles it up, and then there's all the blood. I mean, the blood runs through that book of the Bible like crazy. You know, wine presses with blood pouring down the streets. It's all blood, 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 blood. You know, that's not Jesus.
That's,
you know.
No, that's the Old Testament, yes.
Yeah, totally.
Well,
so that's kind of where a lot of that comes
and
from.
It,
actually,
yeah.
It comes
ends from the Bible, right? It's the last book.
Yes,
and so much speculation and interpretation and the end times and the
prophecies.
You know, I mean,
oh my God.
Yeah, the
people
prophecies
are just so into their prophecies.
And the Urantia book tells us that what John saw, in many ways, he didn't understand, and so in some ways he was frightened by it, right? But he wasn't seeing anything frightening, really.
Yeah.
You know, it's just he didn't have any context. So that's just one example of how the Urantia book clarifies something that, you know, and I guess I'm thinking about it because I just watched this series on Showtime about Waco, the aftermath, and I watched the whole preliminary series on Waco, and I'm fascinated by cult leaders because how because they're the fetish man, they wield undue power and influence over people, and they get people to do things that they probably wouldn't normally do. And I think David Koresh is a great example of that. You know, he, of course, was all about revelation, and he was trying to crack the seven seals. You know, it's just interesting to me how you know, that particular book probably makes less sense than any of the other books of the Bible, but gets more attention.
I know.
The part that bothers me about that is at the very end of the book of Revelation, it says, "What not one jot or tittle must be added or taken away from this."
Right.
So, and a lot of Christians get stuck on that.
Take it really seriously, yeah.
They do.
Well, they can't read anything else because
like the Urantia book. You know, I'm sorry, it's an extra jot and tittle, folks. so yeah. Anyway, Yeah.
Well, our friend
amazing.
Dwayne Faw used to say, and he was a biblical expert, he used to say, well, that's not the only disclaimer in the Bible. There's another one. And I can't remember now where it was, but he could name it, you know, book reference right immediately and say, go read that. He says a similar thing. Nothing shall be changed. And so he would say to Bible people who came up at the booth, so does that mean that everything that fell after that point, does that invalidate the whole New Testament? You know,
oh.
And they kind of would scratch their head, you know.
Oh. Well, then what about all the different translations, different versions
well,
of the
right.
Bible?
Well,
so Bible Gateway is just like, I don't know, hundreds or a hundred or more. You know, how can these versions all be so different?
if
they all be infallible simultaneously if they're all different, you know?
Yeah. And which
exactly.
one is the most infallible? Right. Which version?
Right.
Yeah,
more
right.
infallible
yeah.
than you are. More
yeah.
infallible than thou.
Right. Well, that was a nice little diversion. I'm sorry to sidetrack us with that. But
oh, no.
It's
oh, no.
just,
well, we're
know.
About to read about the knowledge of God, right?
That's right.
Yeah, God's
these
universal
are
knowledge.
Sources of knowledge. You know, our existing evolutionary sources.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
all that.
Point,
so all the world had to work with until the Joshua came along.
That's true.
I mean, the prior, earlier revelations, there's traces of those, too, but... This, you know, but, and now with knowledge, we have this access, you know, digitally, remotely.
Right.
That kind of puts things at our fingertips that in the old days, and even in my own case growing up, I remember I had to actually go to the library if I wanted to find out something, if I had a question about something or wanted to learn about it. I had to literally go to the library, go to the card, do each decimal card drawers, you know,
yeah.
try to look up the topics and get a little number, go up into stacks and try and see if that book was even there. Usually it wasn't.
Look on the microfiche. Remember that? You had to look on
and,
the
oh,
yeah,
microfiche. Yeah, that too.
And now it's all at your fingertips. God
right.
bless the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. It's all at your fingertips. So. You know what to look
right.
for and how to look. It's there, right
funny.
There.
Think about those days, though.
Yeah, that's funny, mm-hmm. Chuck. I somehow get the feeling that you were proficient.
No.
You were a great proficient. At
I just remember the feeling
the
of being in
yeah.
the stacks. You know, the aroma of the books. You know, the books all have this sort of smell about them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And when you open them up, you know, you get that, I don't know, it's kind of cool. You know, you get a sort of
yeah.
almost a feeling about it, you know.
It's history. History,
things.
Right
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
very visceral, isn't it? To sit
yeah.
with a book. And that's why I think books are not going to
yeah.
go out of style. There's something about getting intimate with a book
mm-hmm.
and just sitting there with
mm-hmm.
a book and turning a page that, you know.
Yes. And
nothing
underlining
compares.
The heck out of it.
Yeah, right.
But then if it's a library book, though, you can't do that. So then you have to,
no,
yeah, you can't
like,
no.
you
right.
have to copy it or something. You know?
Yeah, you can sure tell my books.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
me too.
Yay.
That's funny.
Anyway,
well,
but that wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't.
No.
Think about that. 30 years ago, we were still doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So now
you
we
know.
Have this concept of the cloud. The cloud.
Yeah.
The mysterious
everything
cloud.
Everything is in the
cloud. Where everything resides.
Now,
yeah,
now
cloud.
We have AI. You know, my son-in-law was telling me the next iteration of AI on Google is going to be, you'll ask a question and the first response you'll get back is Google's AI response. That'll be interesting.
Mm.
See how that goes.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Well, you know, that's what they say. Control the information can control your thinking. So we got to be
yeah.
a little careful where we go
yeah,
with that.
Yeah, for sure.
But,
for sure.
I mean, a lot of things, you know, if you're trying to figure out how to fix your toilet or something.
So well, forewarned is forearmed. You know, these are definitely double-edged swords, but,
yes.
you know,
yes.
with regard to any power, you know, we get used to things. It used to be that people would decry the fact that we had horseless carriages that could now go at the breakneck speed of 25 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was...
Yeah, they're noisy.
You know, all of that. You know, we seem to have gotten over that one. And, you know, the way that it's... The way that it's put very nicely in the Arantia book in paper 72 is talking about that government on a neighboring planet and speaking about them saying, and they are slowly gaining control over their machines, indicating they probably are dealing with what we're dealing with or were, you know, 100 years ago, and that This is part of evolution, and especially on an unspiritualized world, we are having to deal with the fact that technology can outpace the spiritual attitudes and development that would allow for the self-control that would make the best use of these tools. We don't have that. It's the Wild West here. You know, we have people that are willing to go no holds barred to do whatever it is they want to do. And that's the problem.
Yeah,
the problem.
The moral compass is more important now than ever.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
You can't. We're at the point now, we can't progress further without an elevation of that moral compass, because what ends up happening is those powerful technological developments, those increases in power, can countermand, you know, the good uses of that same power.
Exactly.
So that you end up in a stalemate or worse. It's always easier to destroy than to create. And if you know, it's the why do the heathen rage factor here.
Yes,
any negative or evil move requires narrow focus and doesn't require any kind of wide focus. All you have to do is
exactly is
undermine one aspect of something, and something that relies on a creative network, that relies on creative integrity and broadness, can easily be undermined. And so we're at that juncture now. And you know, I'm not in agreement with so many people that think of the Arantia book as an emergency revelation, but if it is in America, because I just think we need it to progress to the next stage. But the other side of that coin, and what makes it an emergency, if it is an emergency, is the fact that without this development, we will undermine any progress we make. Without spiritual development that goes commensurately with cultural development, with any other kind of technological power, and let's face it, knowledge is power. Without the commensurate spirituality to go with it, we will undermine any forward movement we make. And we need to guard against that. And that's not being adequately thought about, because too few people understand that the true power behind good morality is spirituality, and a dynamic spirituality is the only spirituality that will allow for a dynamic and progressing morality. We can't rely on cookie cutter morality anymore. The Ten Commandments are insufficient for dealing with self-driving cars that have to make a decision on whether or not to hit one person or five.
Exactly.
That's insufficient.
Yeah. Wow.
Good point.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah,
Thank you.
We have to readapt every generation, right? Doesn't it say that we have to learn to readapt and readapt again, and, you know, all of our thinking about
well,
so many,
here that, I think,
so much.
Andre, Andre was hinting at about how some of these developments contain within them the seeds of their own retrogression. You know, that's from that paragraph about the integration.
Oh, yes.
But they, you know, they're trying to tell us, you know, pretty clearly, look, your the wisdom of your worship has to keep up with your development at the material level. Otherwise,
Well,
the inner
there's real danger there. Yeah.
Well, there's danger in the development, but there's also danger in culture not keeping up, because the other side of that is those that are so reactionary that they fear every development. And when your only guard is fear as opposed to the development of adequate wisdom for dealing with things, well, you don't have progress in a society that way. Reactionary attitudes toward everything that happens is not the way to go forward. Mm-hmm. And that, unfortunately, is, I mean, it's the same idea as the sabot in the machine, right? The origin of the term saboteur. They took their wooden shoes and threw them into the gears to get the gears to stop. Why? Because the machines were taking away their jobs. Never mind that they might have better jobs coming. Never mind that as well, the bosses needed to be thinking as well about how do we employ people? How do we take the people that we're going to put out of work and put them into better work? This is the problem. We don't have people thinking about people. In the main, that's a scant minority of humanity that does that. And that is the problem. Not the developments in technology as much as the fact that they develop without the attitudes that need to go with them.
That's why the service motive needs to replace the profit motive. But here is the thing that I was referring to, and this is from Rodin, and it's just so perfectly summarizes what we've been saying. This is from paper 161.3. The more complex civilization becomes, the more difficult will become the art of living. The more rapid the changes in social usage, more complicated will become the task of character development. Every 10 generations, mankind must learn anew the art of living if progress is to continue. And if man becomes so ingenious that he more rapidly adds to the complexities of society, the art of living will need to be remastered in less time, perhaps every single generation. If the evolution of the art of living fails to keep pace with the technique of the urge of living, attainment of the satisfaction of present desires, thus will humanity remain immature. Society will fail in growing up to full maturity. I don't know if Rodin really said that or if that's a little midway or commentary thrown in there.
Yeah, really.
You know, it's hard to imagine that's it's possible, I guess, that a philosopher of Rodin's caliber could have seen that. But
well said. Yeah,
they're definitely taking liberties to adapt it in modern phraseology. But
that's true.
It's clear that he was aware of some of these trends, you know, and whether he said, you know, every single generation. He might have thought that, even if he didn't. It's
the world even then is going through changes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With the Roman Empire and all that. Yeah.
Everything can change faster, and there's some reference to the idea of suddenlies, right? Or some reference to the idea that.
Mm-hmm.
Even in a slowly developing civilization, it can be in a single generation a major change. And, well, obviously for us, the horse is well, and the many horses are well out of the barn. They are all galloping forward.
Mm-hmm.
We're definitely changing at least as fast as every generation, if not faster.
Yeah, every few years, it seems like to me. There's some major, there's some major jump in technology. So, yeah, we're in. Which goes to your point, Andre, about morality. And that's why we need to know God. And here we are in the first five papers, paper three, section three. So should we start reading that?
Was this one last
Absolutely, it's 40 minutes.
They say that goodness is stabilizing. Goodness is stabilizing. And that always kind of stuck with me. When in the midst of all this, you know, rapid change and development, and who knows what's really going on, is anybody in control? You know, it can get pretty freaky. But to remember the goodness is stabilizing. Okay, let's seek the good. And God is, you know, how we... God is our mentor as far as goodness is concerned. So by knowing God, we get a better sense of goodness, and that will have a stabilizing effect.
And that is
whatever.
Definitely what we need on this planet is to stabilize.
Right.
Well, who wants to read section three? Chuck, do you want to?
I'll read it. Go ahead.
Oh, Pam. Okay. All right. God's universal knowledge. God knows all things. The divine mind is conscious of and conversant with the thought of all creation. His knowledge of events is universal and perfect. The divine entities going out from him are a part of him. He who balances the clouds is also perfect in knowledge. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, said your great teacher of the insignificant sparrow. One of them shall not fall to the ground without my Father's knowledge. And also, the very hairs of your head are numbered. He tells the number of the stars. He calls them all by their names. The Universal Father is the only personality in all the universe who does actually know the number of the stars and planets of space. All the worlds of every universe are constantly within the consciousness of God. He also says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people. I have heard their cry, and I know their sorrow. For the Lord looks from heaven. He beholds all the sons of men. From the place of his habitation, he looks upon all the inhabitants of the earth. Every creature child may truly say, he knows the way I take, and when he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. God knows our down-sittings and our uprisings. He understands our thoughts afar off and is acquainted with all our ways. All things are naked and open to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. And it should be a real comfort to every human being to understand that he knows your frame. He remembers that you are dust. Jesus, speaking of the living God, said, your Father knows what you have need of even before you ask him. God is possessed of unlimited power to know all things. His consciousness is universal. His personal circuit encompasses all personalities, and his knowledge of even the lowly creatures is supplemented indirectly through the descending series of divine sons and directly to the indwelling thought adjusters. And furthermore, the infinite spirit is all the time, everywhere present. We are not wholly certain as to whether or not God chooses to foreknow events of sin, but even if God should foreknow the free will acts of his children, such foreknowledge does not in the least abrogate their freedom. One thing is certain. God is never subjected to surprise. omnipotence does not imply the power to do the non-doable, the ungodlike act. Neither does omniscience imply the knowing of the unknowable. But such statements can hardly be made comprehensible to the finite mind. The creature can hardly understand the range and limitations of the will of the Creator.
Interesting.
It's amazing to contemplate that, isn't it?
All these quotes in that one long paragraph, some of those are pretty remarkable. I don't know where they all come from. Maybe they're all from the Bible. But I don't know.
I think they are, Chuck. I've been looking them up, and I think that they're mostly from, you know, like the Psalms and other parts of the Bible like that, which, again, you know, here you go. It's like Duane used to say, the Urantia book makes my Bible come alive.
Well,
and
yeah.
It's so true.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Exactly.
You know. But,
yeah.
But I'm struck by the fact that, you know, they give us the omnipotence and omniscience of God, but they don't call it that in these sections. God's everywhereness would be his omnipresence, right? His infinite power would be his omnipotence, and his universal knowledge would then be his omniscience. Do you think that's correct?
Yeah. Well, they do mention.
Yeah.
They mention omnipotence in the last paragraph.
The last paragraph.
And omniscience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the last paragraph.
So his universal knowledge is his omniscience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, and they're trying to downstep it for us.
Yeah. Right.
Right. You know what I found interesting too is on the third paragraph. God is possessed of unlimited power to know all things. So it sounds like the power precedes the knowing of all things.
Mm. That's
the power to know all things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that consciousness is universal. That struck me because because you think, okay, so what if you had, I mean, we don't even have universal consciousness of our own body, you know? Honestly, diseases can sneak up and kill us and we didn't even, weren't even aware we had it, you know? Just so to think that he knows, you know, and then it goes on to say how he knows all the planets and stars by their names. You know, that's extraordinary to be that conscious of everything. But then that is God.
Yeah.
He is conscious.
Well, he's also conscious of every personality through the personality circuit. You know, and they say that in another part of the book. You know, he has personal cognizance of all the thoughts and actions of every personality, you know, and all of universal existence. I mean, it's pretty remarkable to think about that.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to our relationship with the Father, that becomes very intimate. I'm glad the Father knows what I'm thinking, you know, because I want to be sharing my inner experience. But that means we can talk to God, and that's sort of the implication of that.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk to God and be heard. I mean, we kind
and
of
be understood.
Kind of do that through the adjuster, but the adjuster is pre-personal. Whereas the personality circuit, you know, they hint at it here. Where did they mention that? His personal circuit encompasses all personalities. Yeah, so in that sense, they're talking about the personality circuit, his personal circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Encompasses all personalities. So you could take, oh, man, I'm going to get lost in the mix somewhere. There's countless personalities in the grand universe, but I can't even imagine. But yet we still have this one-on-one individual line of connection to the first source and center. It's, you know, it's pretty awesome.
I'm really challenged by this. Yeah, it is very comforting. We are in good hands. this paragraph 4 is really it calls out the philosopher here. We are not wholly certain as to whether or not God chooses to foreknow events of sin. Even if God should foreknow the free will act of his children, and such foreknowledge does not in the least abrogate their freedom. So, but one thing is certain, God is never subjected to surprise. I can't help but think he already knows what we're going to do because he knows who we are. He really knows who we are. He just steps back and lets us do what we do and tries to help us along the way.
Maybe he even has a plan, knowing us that well.
No way.
He has.
No way.
No.
Do you think?
Yeah.
But, you know, to me, that speaks to why so many times the book reiterates not to give advice unless it's asked for. Because God knows you, or me, all of us, and knows exactly probably what we'll do in any given set of circumstances. So has planned a course of action that is needed for us. And some of the things that we might try to dissuade each other from may be exactly what God intended us to do, to learn a certain lesson that was valuable to us. It may not be valuable to anyone else. But for us, it was vitally important. And we so often attempt to dissuade each other or influence each other, which may be in direct, opposition of what God had planned.
It's so true, Paula. And quite often when we do that, we're doing that for our own sake. Because of our own fear of what they might do or whatever. In other words, there's the self interest in trying to get people to change. You know, it's a subtle thing, and you're right. It's delicate to have to step back. It's a balance.
And they tell us, unless it's asked for. You know, and then, okay, so that's different. If it's asked for,
right.
Now it's an act of free will. I've asked you for your opinion and advice, and now you're going to give it to me because I've asked. So that's in direct response to my reaching out with my will for your advice. Now you're going to give it to me, and I can take it or leave it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I've asked for it. That's the difference. If God never coerces us, then, you know, who are we to coerce each other? And if the Most Highs of the universe stand back in merciful respect of the prerogatives of will, who are we not to do that?
Well, and, you know, and that also ties in with our not interfering with other people's freedom.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of that going on today, and we got to be, you know, that's going against the way God does things, you know. So
that's why we need laws.
And we need moral compasses, and we need a bigger picture of how we all work together, you know. It's like
learn to choose better, you know. It's just an interesting to me, you know. I've thought about this a lot, and thanks for getting philosophical, Pam, and pointing that out, because you know, he does know what you're gonna, he can foreknow. Based on everything he knows about us, he knows us better than we know ourselves. And, you know, and I've thought about often, okay, so if God foreknows or could foreknow, and I believe he could foreknow sin, why put Lucifer in charge? And that's just something I've thought about a lot, and I'd be interested to know what you guys think of that.
Because Michael is mercy dominated, and he will give people the benefit of the doubt. That's where I come from.
So there's a chance that Lucifer may not have gone astray. So they can't completely foreknow free will. Is that
That's what
even
I
do. Yeah.
Even if they can foreknow, it's even if it's a high likelihood that that's going to happen, there's still a matter of if you then use your observation to take an action that is effectively a judgment, then you are curtailing the ability of the universe to evolve through all things.
You
have to allow for a person's personal choice. And as much as I understand that intellectually and agree with it intellectually, who likes that?
Ouch.
Who doesn't wish for bad actors to be, you know, mm-hmm. removed? There was some kind of sci-fi show that I just happened on one time, where somehow these aliens at some point would just withdraw, would pull, you know, these rather powerful, nearly superhuman aliens on the Earth, just extract them. You know, if they didn't like what was happening, they would just extract them and they were gone.
Like a vacuum
cleaner? They flew up into the air. Pardon?
That sounds like a good sci-fi, Andrea.
Yeah, yeah.
That you just happened to
get out
upon
the cosmic vacuum.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, and it was pretty remarkable, and it speaks to the idea of why don't the gods, you know, act more decisively and more summarily when they see something going wrong. And well, that's what would happen if that was
right.
happening. You would see people, you know, being extracted very quickly.
They'd be perceived as tyrants.
Yes. Well,
yeah,
it
would
be.
Go ahead, Pam, sorry.
It gets back to individual freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Individual will choice. Freedom is so much a part of how our God operates. And we have to be able to explore the far reaches of where that goes and the consequences thereof. Otherwise,
it's clearly
his
way. It's clearly his way.
Which, you know, creates lots of chaos. Mm-hmm. But it's all a part of becoming universally knowledgeable like he is. You know, we have to learn all
mm-hmm.
those aspects.
Well, Jesus
ourselves.
I mean, Jesus, one of his central teachings was about originality. You know, originality
mm-hmm.
and initiative, you know. And that's
mm-hmm.
what
mm-hmm.
makes new things happen. That's how we create value.
Mm-hmm.
If you just
mm-hmm.
do predictable behavior over and over again, you know, you're going to just be
right.
stuck. So.
Right.
So there has to be an allowance for that. Yeah. And also,
mm-hmm. I think with free will, there's always a chance you might choose differently, too. I think God and the universe and all the loyal beings of the universe of universes would give that opportunity to happen. You know, just like they would give you the opportunity to choose wrong and make original mistakes and whatever, so that, you know, and that
mm-hmm.
the Supreme obviously loves that and grows with that. And it's,
that's how
it
learns.
It all works to good. It all works to good. But, you know, I think also there's always the chance that someone might choose differently.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can I read?
Go
can
either
I read,
way.
Can I read a paragraph
mm-hmm.
here? Is it kind of speaks to that? And I wonder if this, well, your thoughts are whether this applies to God or not. You know, that's just sort of my question. Anyway, this is in paper 12. It's section 6 about universal overcontrol, right? So that's a kind of sort of related to what we're reading about. And it's paragraph 5 in that section where they say, the universe is highly predictable only in the quantitative or gravity measurement sense. Mm. Even the primal physical forces are not responsive to the linear gravity, nor are the higher mind meanings and true spirit values of ultimate universe realities. I don't know if I read that right. Yeah, even the primal physical are not responsible for linear gravity, nor are the higher mind meanings and true spirit values of ultimate universe realities. In other words, those things are not predictable in the same way that physical behavior that is responsible to linear gravity is predictable.
Right.
And then they go on to say, qualitatively, the universe is not highly predictable as regards new associations of forces, either physical, mindful, or spiritual, although many such combinations of energies or forces become partially predictable when subjected to critical observation. And then here's the kicker. They say when matter, mind, and spirit are unified by creature personality, we are unable fully to predict the decisions of such a free will being.
Excellent.
So this is written by a perfecter of wisdom, I think.
Which section was
that
in? Yeah,
perfector of wisdom. That's in, again, paper 12, section 6.
6, thank you.
Universal over control. It's the fifth paragraph.
And paper 12 is the universe of universes, which just goes to show these gems are hidden throughout the book. You can't judge a paper by its title.
It touches on so many things. Where he says, we are unable fully to predict the decisions of such a free will being. I mean, who is we in that sentence? That's sort of what I'm trying to get to. Assuming that must be below the level of creator deity.
Well, we divine counselors.
Well, are we the universal overseers? Those of us who are overseeing this grand project for God.
We may
not know everything God knows, but we know a lot, and we are overseeing this on behalf of God. We're the loyal, beings who are charged with this work. And that, to me, that's who we is. You know, when they say we, they're the ones taking care of us on God's behalf.
In the sentence before they say, we can sort of figure it out based on critical observation, you know, where they say, things become partially predictable when subjected to critical observation. So this we, again, is a type of being or a whole realm of being where observation and analysis is required to achieve prediction. Whereas I think there's more like an inherent foreknowledge on the level of creator deity that's not based on analysis and observation. You know, sort of a direct knowing of some kind. You know, when what we were just reading about God, you know, the omniscience of God, that God knows all things, you know, that's not based on analysis and observation in the same way they're talking about here, I don't think, in that paragraph. It's like God just knows directly. Or like they talk about the angels, you know, they know how many hairs we have too. But they don't count them. They just know, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
This whole business about
foreknowledge is tricky.
It is tricky, Chuck. That's a good point. And I think, you know, he sums it up by saying one thing's for sure, God is never subjected to surprise. You know, I think that's the key right there, that, you know, when you're thinking about Lucifer, because I mentioned him, and why did anybody put him in charge if they knew?
Well, who knew?
That's the thing. I was just going to say, they say we saw some of these traits, some of these tendencies,
Well, in Calgary, they say that.
But, yeah, but they didn't foreknow, you know, that it was going to all go awry. They saw some concerning problems, but, you know, they gave Lucifer the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, they didn't really have any reason not to.
Yeah.
Because he was designated as one of the 100 most able and brilliant personalities in more than 700,000 of his kind.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Lucifer,
which
he was number 37 of his order.
That would explain why he so thoroughly fell in love with himself, right?
Well,
he was so enamored with himself.
Yes.
But
his
Luciferian
brilliance. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it got turned, of course, yeah. But before that happened, you know, he was counted among one of the most able and brilliant of his order.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have gone either way.
From such a magnificent beginning, through evil and error, he embraced sin and is now numbered as one of those system sovereigns in Ebanon who have succumbed to the urge of self and surrendered to the sophistry of spurious personal liberty, rejection of universal allegiance and disregard of fraternal obligations, blindness to cosmic relationships.
Yeah. Well,
but then there's that other place where they said, well, we started to notice something was not quite right in Lucifer's mind.
Well, that's where I was referring to, that they said, we were starting to notice that, but, you know.
Well, that was after he'd already been assigned that position.
So to Andre's point about God would not, they won't just extract these, you know, troublesome beings with troublesome tendency. They won't just extract that, you know, they let it play out. And that was the wisdom that when Gabriel sought the wisdom of the universes, the ancients of days, right? They said, let it play out.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you get the sense that Gabriel, and boy are we. And he wasn't too, I got the sense when I read that he wasn't too pleased with that answer.
Well, probably
not. himself sent him on to get it, right? Michael himself said, go get that answer from them. And they said, let it play out.
Wait, which answer from them? You're talking about after the rebellion started?
Yeah.
In terms of how to handle the rebellion.
Right.
Itself. Yeah, that's a whole other matter.
Right.
Then they have to let it play out.
Then,
they have to let it play
even
out.
Then they
yeah.
didn't extract, you know, they
right.
didn't just
yeah.
extract it.
That would make it worse.
Well, they left two detractors on the planet. Yeah, they left two. Yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah.
No vacuum suck for Dalagastia and Calagastia.
Right,
well,
which would make it worse if they did that.
Yep, yep.
So the quickest way to end rebellion, you know, according to the Mother Spirit, to provide unlimited opportunity for sin expression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So everybody can see that oh, yeah, I
yeah.
do that.
Yeah, everybody can see if they understand the bigger picture, but a lot of people can't see because they haven't embraced
they get
the
caught
bigger
up
picture.
They think,
yeah,
wow,
I mean,
to do that.
It's a very confusing planet, you know, and that's why this book, this revelation is so valuable.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thanks for tackling that one, you guys. That was
one up.
Right. Well, the other thing to remember is how old these beings are. I mean, the Lenonidex were created, you know, one of the first beings to send, you know, the universe suns that were created way back in the beginning, like, I don't know, 300 billion years ago, something like that. So, you know, he's been around for a long, long time and had a flawless record. So you have to wonder, I mean, this is all very recent in that, you know, within that frame.
Yeah,
Lucifer's rebellion is very recent. So, but they say we are certain of only one thing, and that is whatever these first beginnings were, they had origin in Lucifer's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then they speculate there must have been a pride of self that nourished itself to the point of self-deception, so that Lucifer, for a time, really persuaded himself that his contemplation of rebellion was actually for the good of the system, if not in the universe.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and if you think of all those years that he had pre-existed, and part of his manifesto was there is no God on paradise. So all of those years he was not knowing about the God on paradise, or he just didn't like having to wait that long.
He came to the conclusion.
Yeah,
he changed his mind. He came to the conclusion.
He changed his mind, yeah.
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 He decided he didn't believe any of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and then Michael was behind foisting this false claim.
Right.
Yeah.
I wanted to point out to something from the section we just read that struck me. They refer to Jesus as your great teacher. Did you guys notice that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, in what we just read?
Yeah, in what we just read.
Oh, yeah. Where was that?
Jesus
speaking of the living God.
No. It was right before that. It's for your great teacher said. Let's see. Oh, yeah, here it is. It's in paragraph one. Said your great teacher of the insignificant sparrow, one of them shall not fall to the ground without my Father's knowledge. I actually went and looked that one up, and it's from Matthew. And so I thought that's interesting. They refer to him as your great teacher.
So that was Jesus truly who said that?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. Huh, that is interesting. You're a great teacher.
Yeah.
Well, he certainly was that.
Then later he refers to him as Jesus again and says Jesus said something,
yeah.
You know, and Jesus, speaking of the living God, said, your Father knows what you have need of even before you ask him. So I just thought that was interesting, that, you know, this divine counselor referred to Jesus as our great teacher.
That's a nice twist.
It is. Yeah.
In the use of language.
There were a lot of biblical quotes in that section. I think we did mention that, but, you know, there's a lot, especially in that second paragraph in that section. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that's interesting is that, I mean, when we get into the, I don't know how far we're going to continue with this, but when they get into talking about the infinite spirit, omniscience is one of the essential characteristics of the infinite spirit, and it gets developed much more fully. But I think we kind of assume that whatever capacity the infinite spirit has, the Father has too. But they even mentioned that. Actually, they mentioned that in what we just read. Where was that? Oh, yeah, and then the third paragraph where they say, God is possessed of unlimited power to know all things. His consciousness is universal. His personal circuit encompasses all personalities, you know, the personality circuit. And his knowledge of even the lowly creatures is supplemented indirectly through the descending series of divine sons and directly through the indwelling thought adjusters. And furthermore, the infinite spirit, all the time, everywhere, present. So there's omnipresence. The infinite spirit has omnipresence. So the mother spirit shares that. She's also omnipresent throughout her local universe. So.
The one thing about science that just intrigues me, and they put this in the sense of God's universal knowledge and omniscience, which is omniscience, right? And science is knowledge. And, you know, they tell us in another place that we're in the age of enlightenment, an age of science and truth. I find it interesting that the scientist, at least currently, is willing to throw God out of the equation. When that is the source of knowledge, and God is, and But the scientist right now, the more he studies the physical world and the more enlightened he becomes, is thinking God didn't have anything to do with it. But I honestly have faith that that won't always be the case. I know in my heart that the scientists, the further they go in their study, the more inevitably they will find the first cause. You know, it just can't be avoided. The deeper they go in their own scientific exploration, the closer they'll come to God. And sooner or later, the scientist will have to admit, oh, this is God. You know, there's no other explanation.
You know, they are getting closer.
I mean, that's one of the cool things about your answer book. I mean, the things I really loved about it from the very beginning, is that we're all called upon to be scientists, philosophers, and religionists. You know, it's kind of our responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, causation, duty, worship, these inherent responses of the cosmic mind. We're all called upon to develop those. So what that means is we're all supposed to become scientists, philosophers, and religionists, in our own way. And, you know, those are our paths of discovery of the nature of reality. So if a scientist, maybe his career is in science, but he's also pretty developed in his philosophy and his religion, that's going to be part of, you know, he's going to bring that reality frame to his science.
Well,
so he's not
going
to leave God out. You know, he's not going to, I mean, it isn't really the realm of science to, you know, do measurements and stuff about God. But if you, you know, if you approach science with the understanding that, it's divine.
Well, and that's, that's just a really good point. And, that to me, the role of philosophy is you're allowing yourself a perspective that can make sense of both physical and spiritual. It's the balance. It's the balance wheel. You know it.
Well,
a unified character.
Well, just think, if you go back and look at sort of the early days of science, even in times of Galileo and around that, the scientific discoveries, they didn't really disturb their religious faith. They weren't seen to be so much in opposition or competition. You know, that came more in the 19th century, I think, and then intensified into the 20th century, where suddenly you have religion and science at war with each other over who has the final answer about reality. But going back earlier times, even though things are, you could say, relatively primitive by comparison in terms of cosmological understanding and stuff, nonetheless, people were believers. I mean, Galileo was a believer. He wasn't an atheist. He was a believer. And he worked within the church. And
Einstein was a believer.
Well, in sort of his own way. He's more of a Spinozan type. But, there wasn't a sort of, I don't quite how to understand it, how to express it, but the unification of reality wasn't understood very well, you know, going into the 19th century. So it was easy for these three fundamental approaches to reality, you know, science, philosophy, and religion, to kind of become disunified, become separated, and then fall into competition with each other.
Well, right.
Which is kind of
and in a way,
so
they're both dogmatic. They can be dogmatic.
Can be.
Well, I want to share what Gary said on the board because it's so beautiful. He said the moment that true science and those who represent it recognize there is design in the universe, everyone has a completely new way towards God that does not require adherence to a religious theology. It will change everything here. I love that. A new way towards God that does not require adherence to a religious theology.
Personal religion.
Beautiful. And I think science, actually, friends, I think science is very close to making that discovery. I do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, scientists.
Yeah.
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 And there's a great quote in Paper 195 about that. And I love the way, you know, Paper 195 mentions scientists and, you know, and there's actually a couple of paragraphs I'd like to read. The first one is 195.718. Any scientific interpretation of the material universe is valueless unless it provides due recognition for the scientist. No appreciation of art is genuine unless it records recognition to the artist. No evaluation of morals is worthwhile unless it includes the moralist. No recognition of philosophy is edifying if it ignores the philosopher. And religion cannot exist without the real experience of the religionist who, in and through this very experience, is seeking to find God and know God. Likewise, is the universe of universes without significance apart from the I Am, the infinite God who made it and unceasingly manages it. And then the other one, that I like so much from when Paper 195 is incredible, I think. But, of course, I know you guys agree with that. It's just such an amazing summation of what all's been said in the book. But this is just a couple paragraphs later, 195.723. The scientist, not science, perceives the reality of an evolving and advancing universe of energy and matter. The artist, not art, demonstrates the existence of the transient morocho world intervening between material existence and spiritual liberty. The religionist, not religion, proves the existence of the spirit realities and divine values which are to be encountered in the progress of eternity. Isn't that amazing statement?
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm. The scientist,
yeah.
Not science.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a personal realities. Yep.
Yeah. They bring it all right home.
Yeah.
I think the inertia is in the institutions, you know, that have their set ways.
Yep. And we just so tend to want to do that, don't we? We want to institutionalize things, maybe so they'll survive.
Yeah. I mean,
it's part of not having a bigger picture, you know, because you don't quite know where you're going. So let's at least hang on to what we know, or what we think we know.
which explains why we value something that's ancient so much. You know, well, it's ancient knowledge; it must be so.
Yeah,
preserve it.
Let's preserve it. Yeah.
I mean, institutions can function for good too. You know, it's like
of course.
Yeah, let's have a science university or something. You know, and we'll get all the best equipment and be the thought leaders and all that kind of stuff, and it's all on the up and up. But then, all of a sudden, it's the funding. Providing the funding as their own.
Yeah.
Idea.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That you have to do your research in a particular direction or come to certain foreordained
maybe we need to learn to celebrate what we don't know as much as what we do know.
Yes.
Right. The spirit of curiosity.
Feast upon uncertainty. Fatten upon disappointment.
Right.
Celebrate the unknown.
Celebrate it.
Go out and find it. Go discover, kids. There's a universe to discover out there. It's all for the taking. If you'll just go look and see.
Well, there's that thing in science. My dad was kind of a scientist, so I sort of grew up with some of this stuff. And there is this thing of just pure investigation or just pure curiosity.
Yeah.
Just wanting to know.
True.
Curiosity,
about reality.
Yes.
And you just, you know, you follow the crumbs, you follow the leads, you do the tests, you do the experiments, and the thrill in the idea that you're actually just learning about reality with no other motivation.
Yes.
It's kind of a purity to it. It's kind of like art for art's sake, only it's science for science's sake, kind of.
Yeah.
And when it's approached like that, it's a, you know, it's a, almost like a, well, I don't know, it connects you to reality. in a profound way, or you have that feeling. And it's when it starts getting pushed or the motivations behind it become distorted by other priorities, other factors, money being a big one, you know, because there's always the funding issue for any kind of scientific research. So those influences come in. But there is that level where it is pure or can be. And that's, I think, where it's really exciting. That's where the real science is. But it's hard to maintain that because, you know, just the infrastructure and the costs and everything else that are involved. So I don't know.
It's interesting that you say there's always the funding issue because it's true with art and philosophy and religion as well. You know,
can be.
There's always the money factor that, you know, think of the great patrons who have paid artists over the centuries to create beautiful things that we all treasure so much. And it was because some patron found value in it and said, you're really talented and I'm going to pay you to go create this altarpiece for, you know. I mean, something like the Sistine Chapel, right? And because there was a patron of somebody with money who funded it. And the same with, with religion. Imagine the great religious movements that wouldn't have happened except that they had funding. Even Jesus needed it. Even Jesus needed donations and a treasurer and somebody to manage the money so that that made the ministry possible.
Well, we are also encouraged, aren't we, to stay, to seek those channels of wealth. In other words, stay aligned with them. I mean, you know, that's part of what we
well-organized channels, That's a
right
idea.
Is that what? Okay. Yeah. Without getting caught in.
No,
it,
I mean,
but,
I think that's wise. Those are wise words.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
But yet, if you want to,
some people are better at that than others.
Right. Well, if you want to explore outside the well-organized channel, you got to kind of fund yourself, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, what Rodin didn't say is how many people are lined up at that well-organized channel.
Yeah, right.
Or trying to figure it out.
You may not get close to it.
Yeah, right.
And some want to build a wall so that no one can get close to it, right?
Yeah, there you go.
except themselves, you know. I mean, it can go either way. But we know from having been so close to so many nonprofit endeavors, all of us, how important funding is. You know, funding makes everything possible. It's interesting the role it plays and the energy that it provides for civilization and for the beautiful things that happen within it. You know, it's extraordinary, really, because nobody can afford to just create without sustaining their own livelihood, you know, without taking care of their own material needs. So funding provides for exploration. It provides for creativity. It provides for religious
ministry. They talk about that.
And leisure,
Having leisure time. You know, the culture doesn't evolve and blossom and grow without people having time to do that.
Right.
They're
just slaving away to make sure they have something to eat tomorrow.
Right. So then when you do,
when do they have
some leisure time, then it's a matter of how well do you use that time.
Right, exactly.
That's a big factor.
Yes, it
is. Well, what a neat discussion, you guys. Thank you. We covered quite a bit there. Do we want to try to read section 4? Limitlessness?
Sure.
Yes.
Andre says resounding.
Well,
yes. Andre.
Resounding.
I love that. Do you want to read it, Andre?
Are you sure, Andre?
Yeah, sure.
Are you sure, Andre?
we, even though God is limitless, we'll have just half an hour to discuss it. We'll see how that goes.
yeah, that goes, yeah.
Our time is not limitless.
Yeah. The successive bestowal of himself upon the universes as they are brought into being in no wise lessens the potential of power or the store of wisdom as they continue to reside and repose in the central personality of deity. In potential of force, wisdom, and love, the Father has never lessened aught of his possession, nor become divested of any attribute of his glorious personality as the result of the unstinted bestowal of himself upon the paradise sons, upon his subordinate creations, and upon the manifold creatures thereof. The creation of every new universe calls for a new adjustment of gravity. But even if creation should continue indefinitely, eternally, even to infinity, so that eventually the material creation would exist without limitations, still the power of control and coordination reposing in the Isle of Paradise would be found equal to and adequate for the mastery, control, and coordination of such an infinite universe. And subsequent to this bestowal of limitless power, force and power upon a boundless universe, the infinite would still be surcharged with the same degree of limitless force and power upon a boundless universe. The infinite would still be surcharged with the same degree of force and energy. The unqualified absolute would still be undiminished. God would still possess the same infinite potential, just as if force, energy, and power had never been poured forth for the endowment of universe upon universe, and so with wisdom. The fact that mind is so freely distributed to the thinking of the realms in no wise impoverishes the central source of divine wisdom. As the universes multiply, and beings of the realms increase in number to the limits of comprehension. If mind continues without end to be bestowed upon these beings of high and low estate, still will God's central personality continue to embrace the same eternal, infinite, and all-wise mind. The fact that he sends forth spirit messengers from himself to indwell the men and women of your world and other worlds in no wise lessens his ability to function as a divine and all-powerful spirit personality. And there is absolutely no limit to the extent or number of such spirit monitors which he can and may send out. This giving of himself to his creatures creates a boundless, almost inconceivable future possibility of progressive and successive existences for these divinely endowed mortals. And this prodigal distribution of himself as these ministering spirit entities in no manner diminishes the wisdom and perfection of truth and knowledge which repose in the person of the all-wise, all-knowing, and all-powerful Father. To the mortals of time, there is a future, but God inhabits eternity. Even though I hail from near the very abiding place of deity, I cannot presume to speak with perfection of understanding concerning the infinity of many of the divine attributes. Infinity of mind alone can fully comprehend infinity of existence and eternity of action. Mortal man cannot possibly know the infinitude of the Heavenly Father. Finite mind cannot think through such an absolute truth or fact. But this same finite human being can actually feel, literally experience, the full and undiminished impact of such an infinite Father's love. Such a love can be truly experienced, albeit while quality of experience is unlimited, quantity of such an experience is strictly limited by the human capacity for spiritual receptivity and by the associated capacity to love the Father in return. Finite appreciation of infinite qualities far transcends the logically limited capacities of the creature because of the fact that mortal man is made in the image of God. There lives within him a fragment of infinity. Therefore, man's nearest and dearest approach to God is by and through love, for God is love. And all of such a unique relationship is an actual experience in cosmic sociology, the creator-creature relationship, the father-child affection.
Wow, what affection.
Cosmic sociology.
Yeah. Don't you love it? I love it.
I do.
Yeah.
I love it.
There's a funny little detail in here that, you know, not to take away from the bigger picture, but I was amused by this in my own case, where they say, in this prodigal distribution of himself,
I love that.
These ministering spirit entities. So I had to look up prodigal. I've heard this word all my life, you know, the prodigal son, whatever, you know, I just sort of assumed I knew what it meant. But when I actually looked it up, it's about having or giving something on a lavish scale. And it can also mean spending money or resources recklessly, wastefully, or wastefully extravagant, which would, I guess, be the case of the prodigal son, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this other definition of having or giving something on a lavish scale would be maybe more the definition they're suggesting here with the Father's gift of these spirits.
So prodigal distribution is lavish distribution.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's great, Chuck. That, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So God is lavish in his distribution of himself.
Well,
which is,
and the
prodigal.
And the prodigal son parable was Jesus' favorite. Probably because it's the lavishness of the Father's love.
The Father's reception of him back. In, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was.
They were both lavish.
Uh-huh.
His spending
was
lavish,
was
but his
reckless.
Father's love was.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So interesting word, huh?
Oh,
interesting.
Yeah, thank you for that.
It encompasses both meanings.
Yeah, it encompasses both meanings. That's true.
Yeah.
You know, I'm struck by the fact that the Father's love in paragraph 6, love is in all caps. And that doesn't happen very often in the Arantia book.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Love shows up in all caps in that paragraph. Mortal man cannot possibly know the infinitude of the Heavenly Father. Finite mind cannot think through such an absolute truth or fact, but this same finite human being can actually feel, literally experience, the full and undiminished impact of such an infinite Father's love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. All caps. Yeah.
We can experience that. And our closest approach is through that.
Uh-huh.
So, therefore, man's nearest and dearest approach to God is by and through love.
Uh-huh.
For God is love. You know, I just can't imagine there's any situation on earth, any problem that couldn't be solved by love. Really.
Mm-hmm.
If we just brought love to bear on that. True care, true,
well, maybe
genuine
to go,
regard,
genuine
concern.
It.
Well, yeah, right.
but
love in the sense of the Father's love, powerful love.
Well, the desire to do good
right.
for others. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Just, you know, that
well,
is
you know,
his limitlessness.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly, a related word to prodigal is prodigious. It just occurred to me.
And
I looked up prodigious, and that's remarkably or impressively great in extent, size, or degree. So the soul of love is, you know, we could say it's prodigious.
It's prodigious, yeah.
And it goes along with his prodigal distribution of himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I want to share.
Those
two words seem to have the same root, is what kind of got me thinking about that.
But yes, right.
Fun to think of the Father's love that way. You know, it's without limit.
Without limit, right. Here's a couple of great quotes from the board. Bob says, as Andre began to read this section, I had an image of the caterpillar being taught the fundamentals of flight. I love that. That is true. That's us. We're the caterpillar, and they're trying to teach us the fundamentals of flight.
Teach caterpillar
great.
How to fly before
you
do
right. Yeah, right. Here you are, caterpillar. Let me begin to. So this may not seem real plausible to you now, but.
Yeah.
And then Terry says, my favorite question in the face of any problem is, what does love do with this? Thank you, Barry. I love that. What does love do with this? What might love do with this?
Mm-hmm.
If we looked at it with the eyes of love, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with love comes patience, tolerance, forbearance, forgiveness, a willingness to try to solve a problem with wisdom.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yes. Allows for insight.
Yeah, right. It's great. What a beautiful section this is.
Oh, isn't it?
God's limitlessness. Yeah.
This,
and how...
Fourth paragraph. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Chuck.
Well, I was going to say, in the fourth paragraph, you know, the book talks about adjusters a lot, but this is a little different here in this first sentence of paragraph four. But they say the fact that he sends forth his spirit messengers from himself to indwell the men and women of your world and other worlds. That's an interesting way of putting it. I could see the truth of that, but that's kind of a cool way of putting it. To think of the adjuster as a spirit messenger.
I like that.
Sent forth by the Father, you know, to indwell our minds. These are spirit messengers. That's kind of cool.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a direct hotline, isn't it? Actually, when you think of it,
it's your
direct line.
Well, it's on
and didn't you love the way that it defined in God's image? Because it gave us a great definition of that in this section, too.
Where was that?
Let me see if I can find it again. Defined God's made in God's image being the fact that we are indwelt by a piece of His perfection. Andre,
which paragraph is that?
Oh, last one maybe, the last paragraph.
Yeah,
what are you looking
for? There it is.
Oh yeah, man is made in the image of God, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a definition for us right there. Finite appreciation of infinite qualities far transcends the logically limited capacities of the creature because of the fact that mortal man is made in the image of God. There lives within him a fragment of infinity. You know, that there's so much misunderstanding about what it means to be made in the image of God.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
There is.
But they're defining that for us. That means that there lives within man a fragment, and women, men and women, a fragment of infinity.
Yeah.
That's a great definition right there.
Yeah.
Of what it means to be made in the image of God. To have that fragment of infinity. It's like that little reflection within.
It takes us beyond our logic.
There's a great little paragraph that sort of emphasizes what you're saying there. This is in paper 6, section 5, the last paragraph. I just love how they put this. They say that though the Eternal Son cannot personally participate in the bestowal of this auto gestures, he did sit in council with the Universal Father in the eternal past, approving the plan and pledging endless cooperation when the Father, in projecting the bestowal of this auto gestures, proposed to the Son, quote, "Let us make mortal man in our own image." And then they go on and say, "And as the spirit fragment of the Father dwells within you, so does the spirit presence of the Son envelop you. While these two forever work as one for your spiritual advancement."
Beautiful. Thank you.
Dwell in and
envelop.
Yeah, that's
from paper six,
aspect.
The Eternal Son. Wow.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Mother Spirit pervades. So we have these three, indwelling, the enveloping, and the pervading.
The pervade. Yeah, wow.
I love
anyway.
That. Let's have a conversation. So, son, what do you think of this? I'm thinking,
I'm
going to.
Yeah, mortal man.
Pass the donuts.
Where's the coffee?
That's good. I love anything that, you know, kind of lets us just have a kind of a human glimpse of God.
Oh, my God.
But this comment about the son, though, being an enveloping presence, I mean,
I love it.
About that in terms of the thought, the spirit of truth.
Right.
You know, Jesus,
yes.
Ability to be with us through the spirit of truth, in a way that would be, you know, an enveloping presence.
Mm-hmm.
I think
absolutely.
Just go with what they say there, which mm-hmm. I like that.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
the idea of the spirit of truth being a comforter, being the comforter, that also kind of goes along with being enveloped.
Right. You think of that. A comforter
kind
wraps
like,
around
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Yeah. Something
mm-hmm.
like that. It's just such a, I don't know. That was such a surprising comment when
I
first read that.
And Michael, being a combination of father and son,
uh-huh.
you know, he's able to envelop us with the spirit of truth. And,
right.
Also, I guess, represents the fatherly aspect of the Creator.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And the motherly aspect, right?
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting feeling wrapped. You know, I have to think that the first thing that we do when a little baby comes out into this great big space that we call the world, after having been enclosed in that comfortable little womb where everything was provided, is we wrap them, we swaddle them in a blanket to comfort them. It comforts them.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
you
wouldn't think that's true, but if you swallow them and you wrap that blanket tightly, not real tight, but just tightly enough to make them feel swaddled, they're comforted by it. You know,
right?
Yes.
So there's something comforting being wrapped.
Well, you know, that's
like back in the womb.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's kind of a protective feeling, which goes along with this other comment they make. That when combined with what I just read about the enveloping presence, I think makes a lot more sense, where they say that since the day of Pentecost, and talking about Caligastian, this traitorous Caligastian, his equally contemptible associate, Daligastian, are servile before the divine majesty of the paradise thought adjusters and the protective spirit of truth. The spirit of Michael, which has been poured out upon all flesh. So the idea that the spirit of truth envelops us, that they kind of goes along with the idea of it being protective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see what I mean by that? Yeah.
Yes.
It's like a true pass message.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yes.
Not exactly.
Right.
You know what I mean.
So the evil one will not touch you. Yes.
you shall not touch.
You can't get through your head, not through.
That's right. Yeah.
Sure,
well,
sure.
You know, yeah,
plus he's
stay
also
behind
servile.
Me, Satan.
He's servile in the presence of the body. Yeah, sure.
Servile.
Anyway.
That's comforting, isn't it? You know, there's a theme in this section, and the theme is, for me at least, one of them, don't worry, kids. God is not going to run out all of these beautiful, wonderful things that we all need to live. And it reminds me of, you know, and you contemplate that, you think, wow, endless supply, limitless supply of everything we need. And I read once when I was a teenager, love adds and multiplies, or no, love divides and multiplies as we share it with each other.
Oh, man.
And that, you know, it makes just makes so much sense, because every bit of love then that's shared again amplifies and, you know, makes that more plentiful.
Uh-huh.
So as we as we share good things with each other, we don't exhaust the supply. We actually make it greater.
Yeah. That's the supreme is growing in that.
Yeah.
We are contributing to the supreme.
Yeah.
So I wonder if, you know, I mean, it makes sense to me. The more, and the fact that God bestows all of this without, you know, it says that he delegates all authority, right? It's possible for him to delegate.
Mm-hmm.
The only things he'll keep for himself are the things that he can't possibly delegate. But if he can delegate it, he does.
Mm-hmm.
So he just bestows everything freely, limitlessly.
You know that
prodigiously, Chuck.
Prodigiously, there you go.
There you go, right.
Well, so in that, keeping that in mind, this last, the first sentence of the last paragraph, it's kind of like, I kind of did a little bit of a what when I read that. because they're saying here that finite appreciation of infinite qualities, okay, finite appreciation of infinite qualities far transcends the logically limited capacities of the creature. So our, you know, we have our logically limited capacities of, you know, understanding and grasp of things, but they're
our
saying that our finite appreciation of infinite qualities far transcends our logically limited capacities, or the logically limited capacities of the creature, because of the fact that mortal man is made in the image of God, which you were just reading. Mm. There lives within him a fragment of infinity. I mean, that alone, I mean, that's like pure Ranch book. The idea
true.
Of a fragment of infinity. Yeah, it's like,
yep.
But there it is. Mm. And that's what gives us this capacity for finite appreciation of infinite quality, which would otherwise be hopelessly limited by our logically limited capacities. I think that's what they're saying, if that makes sense.
Well, it's worth thinking about and reflecting on exactly what that means and what the thought adjuster is doing there. What we know that the thought adjuster is doing is weaving that into our mind matrix, that to the extent that we're giving our assent to espouse higher values and to incorporate aspects of God's nature into our nature, you know, to that extent, one more golden thread gets woven into our soul. And we have no idea exactly how God does that. I mean, it is as close to pure mystery as anything in the universe, not just to us, but to even the higher beings. But that is the key. That's, you think about your first experiences reading the Urantia book. Think about your first experiences reading papers 104, 105, and 106. And then reflect on the fact that in some cases, Well, in some cases, people decide, well, I'm never going to read that again. in other cases, in other cases, you go and you read it again, and somehow you don't know how, but there it is. There's a little more comprehension, a little more comprehensibility. And how did that happen? Because I'm barely closer to being more supreme, ultimate, or absolute in any regard, but somehow God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And that's what's remarkable here is this partnership. Mm.
Partnership.
And that's what's
beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, and that's beautiful. Yes, that's beautiful. And this
that's our finite appreciation right there.
The partnership is our actual experience in cosmic sociology. That is, I love that terminology there, because cosmic sociology is God and man, you know, finite and infinite, father, child. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's an interesting leap of logic in that last paragraph. I don't know if it seemed that way to you guys.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were just making a statement that I was reading that we, you know, our appreciation for the infinite comes from the fact that we have this fragment of infinity within us. And then they say, therefore, man's nearest and dearest approach to God is by and through love, for God is love. So the use of therefore in that sentence, you're talking about logic, you know. It's like, okay. I've got infinity living within me, but therefore, you wouldn't necessarily think of that, I don't think, that our nearest and dearest approach would be through love. You know, it might be through philosophy or comprehending the infinite or something like that, based on the first part of that paragraph. So they throw in that
it's through love.
Yeah.
Because for God is love.
Right.
It goes back to that great quote that says divine things must be loved to be known. Human things must be known to be loved. Mm-hmm. But divine
things. That would include the infinite.
Must be loved to be known. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and love is relationship. You know, it's beyond logic. It's beyond logic.
It's the greatest of motivations, right? Motivating all that is good. I also think of that great quote from the paper on the Supreme that ends in, the more man withdraws from God, the more nearly he approaches non-reality, cessation of existence. When man consecrates his will to the doing of the Father's will, when man gives God all that he has, then does God make that man more than he is.
I love that.
Right. Love that. And it starts with the more closely man approaches God through love, the greater the reality, actuality of that man.
Of that
When we're approaching God with love, then we're becoming more actual.
What is that citation again, Paula?
That's from paper 117-414. God's gift, his bestowal of reality. It starts. Great paragraph. This is Supreme.
That's a
Supreme
paper. Biggie.
That's a biggie. We should read that one of these days, guys. We just have fun going, skipping through.
Skipping through the interview.
Well, what a great study. Thank you so much. We're at the end of that.
Yeah, thank you.
We're at the end of our
delightful.
Time. It was delightful.
Yeah.
How can you go
happy
wrong?
Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day
happy
to Mother. All the mothers and
happy
fathers
Mother's
out
Day,
there.
Mothers.
And all the children.
All the children who all got here through mothers.
All the kids.
Your mothers and fathers. So blessed be you guys.
Yes.
So great always to study with you. Thank you to all of our listeners.
Yes, thank you.
Until next time.
All right.
Until next time.
God bless.
Bye for now.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.